This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The winner will be Pittsburgh, unless it's Carolina or Denver or the Pats, though in Chicago they'll feel fine if it's the Bears. But it could be the Colts, and no one squawks, at least up in Seattle, if it is the Seabound Hawks. Here to discuss the playoff chances of the Seattle Seahawks is John Levesque, a sports columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. Good to be here.
The Seahawks enjoyed a 13-3 regular season. They won the NFC West. How has this team managed to maintain its anonymity, at least outside of Seattle?
Well, I don't know. I guess that's your fault or something.
Probably directly my fault.
We've talked about that. I've written about that. There are those here who say this team gets no respect. And I suppose there is still somewhat of an outpost factor here in Seattle. The fact that most Seattle professional teams always end up traveling more than any other professional team just because of where they are. It's always interesting because I think they enjoy the anonymity for a while, and then when they get good, it's like, well, hey, what about us?
And, we get no respect.
They flip it around and say, yes, nobody notices us.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned they enjoy the anonymity. Does it help them? Does the relative lack of attention paid to the Seahawks work to their advantage now that they're in the playoffs?
I think so. It could be argued that no NFL team really has an advantage over the other one because they all share game films. They all pretty much know each other. There is such an incestuous nature to the coaching business. You know, coaches have been at so many teams and playing with, coaching with so many other coaches in their careers that nothing is really a surprise. Yet, I still think there is some of that benefit to having a team cloaked in anonymity because I do think it has worked to the Seahawks' benefit. They haven't played a particularly difficult schedule this year, and yet they've surprised some teams when they came in here and realized, ooh, we're playing a team that's a little bit better than we thought. The other thing, which is a huge factor, is that Quest Field, their stadium, even though it's an outdoor stadium, doesn't have a roof, is an unbelievably noisy place, and the fans have picked up on that. And so the 12th man, as it were, has really helped the team.
People out there have actually put down their books and their coffee mugs and come out to see the football team.
Well, no, they bring those to the game, but they try to pay attention, between timeouts and stuff.
All right, I confess almost total ignorance about the Seattle Seahawks, and there are even those who've suggested I know too little about the National Football League. But let me ask this: other than wide receiver Steve Largent, who do we look for to have a big game today?
I think Steve is still running for governor or something somewhere, so you don't have to worry about Steve. Sean Alexander, I'm guessing you've probably heard of. He is the running back for the Seahawks and also has been named the most valuable player in the National Football League this year, was the leading running back with 1,880 yards. He probably will have a big game because he almost always has a big game. Matt Hasselbeck this year has kind of been in Sean's shadow, but he's a very, very good quarterback, and he has been voted to the Pro Bowl team. And again, a lot of people back east may not have heard of him. It's a very high-powered offense that plays an up-tempo game. Doesn't mean they do a no-huddle offense, but they play very, very quickly, and the whole idea is to get the defense of the other team a little off balance.
Mike Holmgren led the Green Bay Packers to a Super Bowl championship in 1997, but he has lost three playoff games as a Seahawks head coach. Are people in Seattle still thinking of him as a guy who can't win the big game?
Not so much the guy who can't win the big game, but I think there is some frustration because when he did come here, he had won one Super Bowl, he had taken the Packers to another one, and so I think the assumption was that he would take the Seahawks to the Super Bowl fairly quickly. Well, it's been 7 years now, and we might be there, but you have to remember, the Seahawks haven't done anything yet in the playoffs. They had a first-round bye, so this is their first playoff game today, and they could end up doing exactly what they've done the last few years when they get to the playoffs and lose their first game.
All right, you've talked about what could happen. Tell me about what is going to happen. What's your prediction for today's game?
I think the Seahawks will win. They played the Redskins. The Washington Redskins are their opponent, and they played them during the regular season and lost in overtime in Landover, Maryland. It's a game that most Seahawks watchers feel the Seahawks should have won. They actually had a chance to win it in regulation time, and a field goal attempt by their place kicker, Josh Brown, hit the left upright and bounced backward. And so the game was tied. It went into overtime. So there's this feeling that we should have won this game. We played well enough, and they did. I expect it'll be close. The Redskins play a very, very tough defense, as they evidenced last week against Tampa Bay. But I think at home especially, the Seahawks offense is probably good for an extra touchdown there, and that's what I would expect.
John Levesque is a columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. He joined me on the phone from Seattle. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Bill.
Last weekend's Bobsled Challenge in Lake Placid, New York, was a well-attended promotional event, and one of the most well-represented segments of society there was NASCAR drivers. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein attended that event, and he has this report.
NASCAR. Hot asphalt, sunny tracks in Daytona and Talladega, and millions of fans nationwide. Bobsled. Frozen chutes and icy tracks in Lake Placid and Park City, and legions of fans in Europe. But the two sports do have a couple things in common: speed and the need for highly skilled drivers, which may explain why the 10 NASCAR drivers here all want pole position for their first practice run, even though they're just starting halfway up the track. As bobsled patron number one, Jeff Bodine puts his helmet on first. He hunkers into his shiny red bobsled, a second sledder, his brake man, behind him. Bodine grabs the steering reins.
All right, starts clear.
Okay, here we go.
The sled rumbles into the first turn. Jeff hits it cleanly and disappears down the track. Professional bobsledders top 80 miles per hour on this mile-long Olympic track. Its 20 curves bear foreboding names like Devil's Highway and the Labyrinth.
Throw down at 55.61 seconds.
NASCAR and bobsled sit on opposite ends of the sports world. One laden with media coverage and sponsorships, the other playing third or fourth or even fifth fiddle to the more popular winter sports. But they fit here, like sports cousins. And while the drivers joke and laugh, they want to be good bobsledders. After his first run, Busch Series rookie Joel Kaufman is wide-eyed. He shakes his head.
I'll tell you, TV does these guys no justice. The sled kind of does what it wants at first. By the time we got towards the bottom, you know, it felt to me like we were going pretty fast, and the driver comes into it a lot more, you're getting a little higher in the bankings and hitting the corners a little harder.
With each practice run, the drivers get more psyched up for the actual race, and that's what Bodine hoped for. 56-year-old Jeff Bodine came to bobsledding as a spectator. He watched the 1992 U.S. Olympic bobsled team's woeful performance on TV.
Watching these kids, they were bouncing off the walls, and I thought, well, maybe they need a driving coach. Maybe I could help them.
What they needed was money to design better bobsleds, ones that could outrace those of much bigger German and Italian programs.
No one here in the United States built bobsleds. They had to buy their equipment from their competition, the Europeans, and that just blew my mind. I couldn't believe that American athletes were not using American-made equipment in the Olympics.
Bodine donated $500,000 of his own money to start his bobsled project. He's raised over $500,000 more from sponsors and other donors. He hopes NASCAR's involvement will raise even more. On race day, drivers start three-quarters of the way up the track, faster and more dangerous. The drivers pose with the group Cowboy Crush at the top of the course, a TV taping for the Speed Channel. Hollywood stuntman turned NASCAR driver Stanton Barrett surveys the snaking course below. He pats his sled like he's rubbing a good luck charm.
The bobsled truck will take you down the course, but you screw up, you can crash. You have to be really precise how you approach it. You can overdrive, you can underdrive, you can get off your line. I mean, just a little mistake's 2/10, same in a race car, so it's very tough.
Barrett's brakeman is Grayson Fertig, a U.S. World Cup bobsledder. He sands down the sled's rails like a good pitman.
I'm just trying to give it as clean a surface as possible. We're going to win and lose by hundreds of seconds. Might be hundreds right there.
Fertig says he's thrilled that NASCAR's here.
I think it's going to be a perfect tie, and it makes perfect sense. And I guess the only thing that doesn't make sense is why we didn't do it earlier.
More than 1,000 fans line the track, mostly down at the finish line. There's some grumbling that the biggest NASCAR names aren't here, like Tony Stewart, Jeff Gordon, and Dale Earnhardt Jr. Maureen Blaze and her son Kirby Goodrich drove 3 hours from Springfield, Vermont, and they're not disappointed.
We walked up to the top of the mountain yesterday with Todd Bodine, so you can get really close to the drivers here. Nothing like at a NASCAR race where they're fenced in, you know.
Stanton Barrett hurtles down the track. He nearly spills in a hairpin turn. He gets high fives from fans and drivers as he heads to the leader box with the day's track record of 51.96 seconds.
You're out of control. That
was out of control.
The drivers huddle together and watch the last run of the day on a TV monitor. Nextel Cup driver Kevin LePage beats Barrett by hundredths of a second. With a strong first run, LePage wins the race.
Oh, I tell you, it was awesome. A lot of pressure, you know. We only had two one-tenths, whatever it was.
Bodine's grinning ear to ear. He says the bobsled challenge will take place again next year. What's more important, he says, is for NASCAR drivers to spread the word.
To go back in their different parts of the country and tell people about it, to tell other drivers about it, tell sponsors about bobsledding, tell race fans about bobsledding, and hopefully we'll get a lot more people interested in this sport.
For U.S. bobsledding, it's good to have the country's fastest and fastest-growing sport watching out for you. For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein in Lake Placid.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Don Haskins, who coached Texas Western to the NCAA championship in 1966. But first, a discussion of contemporary men's college basketball teams with Pat Forty of ESPN.com. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Let's start at the top. Duke, the number one team in the country, is undefeated. Perhaps no surprise there. But is the relative ease with which Duke has been beating other ACC teams a surprise?
Yes, it is to me, Bill. I mean, they look like the true giant of that league right now, and that's usually not the way that goes. I mean, even the very best teams generally have to go through some real battles to dominate that league, and right now Duke looks head and shoulders above everyone else, and that's both a commendation to Mike Krzyzewski and his team and an indictment, I think, of the rest of the league that some other teams have kind of faltered, and then there's a lot of youth in there, too, at some other programs.
Also among the undefeated teams at this point is Pittsburgh. How can an undefeated team be ranked as low as 11th when most of the teams ranked above Pitt have lost once, if not twice?
Well, I think the biggest reason, Bill, is that Pittsburgh has left the city of Pittsburgh exactly one time so far. It's quite a feat of scheduling, of cautious scheduling, if you will, that they've managed to load up on home games, mostly against lesser opponents. Their only road game was at South Carolina. Their first really legitimate road test comes Sunday at Louisville, which is another program that really hasn't proved itself because they haven't played hardly anybody anywhere either. So we're going to find out maybe on that day who's a little bit more for real out of those two teams in a very, very good Big East Conference.
Florida is ranked number two amid cries of overrated, and one of the people crying overrated is the Florida coach. Is he right?
I think he's probably right, yeah. I know. I mean, Billy Donovan has done a tremendous job with this Florida team. I think they had a little bit of an addition by subtraction situation last year when Matt Walsh and Anthony Roberson left early for the pros, and that opened up some opportunities to some younger players who were perhaps a little more team-oriented, shall we say. And that's allowed them to get off to a great start. However,
You know, I don't think that even Billy believes that they are the second-best team in the country. I think it's kind of just been more of an act of attrition that has allowed them to rise up there. And I think they have some losses in their future, although the SEC is not great this year. So they look kind of – they're the Duke of the SEC in terms of looking much the best at this point.
Pat, I don't know if it would be fair to designate Boston College as the team wishing hardest that it had never changed conferences, but BC has yet to beat an ACC team. Can they legitimately hope for brighter days?
Well, I would think so, but boy, you're right. Talk about a bad start, and this was a team that last year, you know, got off to that phenomenal start, 21-22-0 in the Big East, and the conference change has not been a good thing so far for that basketball program. I think that that there's enough talent there and experience that they will kind of right the ship and win some games there. But they've been one of the larger surprises and disappointments so far in the season.
Looking westward, which is the more remarkable statistic, that UCLA has won 11 of 12 games or that they've done it while sustaining injuries to seven players?
Definitely the latter, Bill, because that's been a pretty remarkable job by that team of keeping itself together, great resiliency in the face of just a ton of injuries. And, you know, they're one of those teams that I would have said a week ago, watch out for them at the Final Four, but then Josh Shipp, one of their best players, who had tried to come back from a hip injury, basically shut it down for the season and said that he can't go on, so he's going to take off the rest of the year. And I think that really hurts them. Cedric Bozeman's already out. So a good team, but probably going to fall short of being a great team.
Pat, pick for us a team that's been playing possum, as my old friend George Cotta down Cava used to say. Lying in the weeds, but it will emerge as a monster late next month or maybe early in March.
You know, I've been looking around trying to figure out who the possums are out there. There are a few different candidates. I think that it's hard to call Memphis a possum because they're up pretty high in the rankings and they've played very, very well. But I think what people are going to do is forget about them to a degree because they're going to be playing in Conference USA, which is a weak conference. Nobody's going to be watching their games. Nobody's kind of going to be thinking about them. Their strength of schedule is going to slip. But that's a really, really good team. A lot of talent there. And I think that's a Final Four caliber kind of team if they can keep their seasoning, if they don't come into the tournament without having been toughened up with a weak conference schedule.
What about another club besides Florida that's kind of been dazzling people and probably isn't quite as good as it seems to be at this point?
Yeah, a team maybe destined for a little bit of a slide. You know, I think that if you look at the rankings, probably from the Pac-10, Washington got off to a very quick start. They were undefeated. They were ranked in the top 10. It started to come back on them a little bit. Watched them Thursday night against USC, and they were kind of fortunate to win that game. They play, you know, I admire Lorenzo Romar because he lets his guys play, but sometimes he might let them play a little too much. They're a little wild and reckless, and although I don't think they're playing in a great league either in the Pac-10, I think that they probably are due to regress a little bit as the season wears on.
Well, we'll be sure to get back to you next week with all the mail from Washington.
Absolutely. I'll put on my armor and take them on.
Pat Forte writes about college basketball for ESPN.com, and he joins me from time to time to talk about the game. Pat, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Good talking to you.
The mythology of college basketball has it that in 1966, Don Haskins changed everything, coaching Texas Western against an all-white team from the University of Kentucky. In the championship game of the NCAA tournament, Haskins started five black players. Texas Western won. In the aftermath of that result, colleges that had never enrolled black basketball players started recruiting them. Don Haskins, who has spent the last 40 years denying that what he did was a big deal, recently collaborated with Dan Wetzel on a book entitled Glory Road, My Story of the 1966 NCAA Basketball Championship and How One Team Triumphed Against the Odds and Changed America Forever. We'll find out now if that subtitle means Coach Haskins has acknowledged that the 1966 championship was, in fact, a big deal as he joins us from his home in El Paso, Texas. Coach, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm sorry I'm so hoarse.
Well, that's okay. You sound like you just coached a tough game. There's a sort of verisimilitude involved here.
You're exactly right. That's the way you sound after one of those.
And joining me from WDET in Detroit is Dan Wetzel. Dan, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Don, have you agreed that what you accomplished in 1966 changed everything, or are you still arguing with those who feel that way?
Actually, I know I've said that, but after that game, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I received, there must have been 30 or 40,000 hate letters. But when I really realized the significance of the game was about 3 years later, you know, the old Southwest Conference, which now most of it is the Big 12, mm-hmm. I read in the paper, and it showed the all-conference basketball team, and they were all black. And that made me pretty happy because I felt like our game had something to do with all of a sudden black kids around the country getting scholarships.
Dan, I want to bring you into this because you maintain in the parts of Glory Road that are in your own voice that Coach Haskins was not enthusiastic about telling stories in which he was the main character, let alone the hero. Was that frustrating for you trying to write the book?
Yeah, well, one of the classic lines was he had seen some element of a draft of the book and he saw that I had written what he seemed to be the boastful line, "When I was in high school, I was a great free throw shooter," which he was. And he told me that in this autobiography, he didn't want the word "I" to appear because it would sound too boastful. So I then told him it's going to be one heck of an autobiography. So Don Haskins, had he sought the attention, sought the limelight, or had been interested in doing what most coaches do, which is move up the ladder to bigger schools in places where you're more likely to win, could be considered the most famous and greatest college basketball coach of all time. He never wanted any of that. He wanted no attention. He wanted all of the glory to go to his players. And he stayed at the University of Texas, El Paso, rather than going to one of the big schools because he liked it there and was content. And it's an incredible lesson to learn about what contentment really is.
Just to clarify, Texas Western became Texas at El Paso.
Right.
So he stayed at the same place throughout his career. What is the most remarkable story that you could get Don Haskins to confirm?
Oh, I mean, there's so many great ones of the way he had to recruit at this little school. El Paso is just so geographically distant from the rest of the country. You'd have to fly recruits in at night so that they wouldn't see that they were flying over the desert for an hour. He signed his best recruit ever by beating him in a free throw shooting contest. The different stories of him hustling pool and maybe a little golf. This is a man's man. I call him the John Wayne of basketball. It's one thing to be blue collar. It's one thing to be humble when you don't have the choice otherwise. But presented with the choice of being rich and famous and living the so-called good life and choosing otherwise to stay to your roots is remarkable.
Coach Haskins, the 1966 team is the most historically significant team you coached, certainly, and it was a national champion. But you say in the book that coaching this team sometimes nearly drove you crazy. How so?
Well, you know, when you get some good talent, you got guys that don't want to practice hard. I used to be asked the question a lot, how long do you work out? And I said, when I got tired. For instance, I still think as good a defensive team as there's ever been to win the national championship. You know, we held Kentucky. They were averaging in the 90s, and we held them to 65. And I didn't think we got our best effort that night.
He's never satisfied.
I never. you couldn't get them tight. And I think the thing that I enjoy today more than anything else, I had five or six good white players, too. And I never, ever saw or never felt any tension between them. Half of them roomed together. They were just a great, solid group. I was asked by Stephen A. Smith the other day on his show. Mm-hmm. He said, well, what did the white guys think? You're starting, you know, a lot of black players. And I shouldn't have said it the way I did it, but I said I didn't ask them. You know, I tried my damnedest to treat them all alike, and I think it's why everybody got along.
Dan, as you went back and researched what was going on around and after the 66 game, to what extent were the coaches of the teams that were all white back then aware of the fact that things were going to change dramatically fairly soon after Texas Western won the championship with five black starters?
They're quite aware. There's sort of an old saying, I've never been able to pinpoint who said it exactly. It may have been Adolph Rupp, may have been Bear Bryant. It was some coach in the South, though, said, I don't want to be first, but I'm not going to be third when it comes to recruiting black players. They all knew that once that area of the country started accepting black players, the floodgates would open immediately. And none of them had the courage of Don Haskins to be first, but none of them were going to wait any more than second because it was going to change immediately.
And Dan, so, let me say this.
Comes Mr. Humble.
El Paso, Texas is a very tolerant town. I might have been getting hate letters from after it was over from everyone else, but there was 100,000 people at the airport from the airport to downtown El Paso. And I probably couldn't have gotten away with that had I had a president that told me I had a quota. I don't think I would like that.
Which some schools did have at that
time.
They
had quotas. I do remember the athletic director come to me one day and he said, we've got this guy that has this big car company who's one of our biggest supporters, and he thinks you're playing too many blacks. And I didn't change, but when we got on the airplane to go to Maryland to play in the Final Four, I noticed he was sitting in the first class seat, first row.
It wasn't too many when they won, huh?
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
Let me add this counterpoint, because he wants to act like, and it's true, El Paso was far more tolerant than, say, Alabama or Mississippi at that time. However, he received death threats, and as much as in today's society you say who would kill a college basketball coach, they kill freedom riders, they were blowing up churches, they were killing all sorts of people involved in the civil rights movement, and that it was a legitimate threat. He'll never admit it. The second thing is,
Dan,
he was 35 years old. Hold on, Coach. You're 35. He has four kids and a wife. And if that team doesn't work out, if there's any reason he gets fired, he's never coaching again. Because in the NCAA, he was seen as the guy who stuck his neck out. He risked his career and his life to do the right thing. And he's not going to say that was a big deal, but it was.
Well, Dan, as I've told you before, you know, all the rednecks that were calling and with death threats, I don't think any of them could shoot straight enough to hit anyone anyway.
We've talked for some time now without acknowledging that yesterday the movie Glory Road opened around the country. Dan, what's your favorite part of the book that didn't make it into that movie?
Well, I'm not sure it's a favorite, but it's I think it's a poignant story, is what happened after the 66 title. This team was not celebrated by America. Far from it. The establishment, the NCAA, sent investigators down to try to look into the program to see if it was cheating. Sports Illustrated wrote a wild expose that claimed that UTEP and Coach Haskins actually were exploiting the black athlete and that the kids weren't real students, which is completely false and has been borne out in the last 40 years. Adolph Rupp, the Kentucky coach, really made slanderous remarks about the players, that they were criminals. He said David Latin, the star player, had come from Tennessee State prison, when in fact he had come from Tennessee State University and it had no record. James Michener, the great historian, or the great author, I suppose, I don't know about great, he's called it the Texas Western Championship, the most wretched event in the history of American sports. These guys were slandered. They were beaten up by the big media and the establishment, far worse after they won the title than some heckler in the 16th row saying slurs or someone throwing eggs at their bus. And it shouldn't have taken 40 years for this story to be told. And so what's really great about that is watching the look on the face of these players, now 61, 62, 63 years old, and Coach Haskins at 75, finally getting their due. For a long time, Haskins said his life would have been better if he hadn't won the 1966 championship, which is a sad statement, and today I think he no longer would say such a thing.
Don Haskins coached the 1966 team from Texas Western, now known as Texas El Paso, to the NCAA championship. He joined me from his home in El Paso. Don, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much, Bill. Adios.
And Dan Wetzel, who collaborated with Coach Haskins on the book Glory Road, published by Hyperion, joined us from WDET in Detroit. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at...
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, chowing down for the record. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce via telephone as he heads for Denver for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. I'm in the Atlanta airport, and as they say down here, when you die, you can go to heaven or hell, but you've got to change planes at this airport.
All right. There are two NFL Division Championship games today. The first pits Seattle against Washington. The second has the Pats a mile up in Denver. Tomorrow, Pittsburgh plays Indianapolis. Carolina plays Chicago. Which teams advance?
Well, I think that Seattle is the most underrated good team in the history of the NFL, and I think they're going to advance. And I think the New England Patriots have one more left in them, and I think they're going to go up to Denver and win that game. On Sunday, I think that the Bears' run ends. I think Washington's playing well enough now to beat them. And I also believe that Pittsburgh goes into Indianapolis and beats them up within an inch of their lives and loses the game. So I think Indianapolis advances. And we get Peyton and Tom and the Patriots in Indianapolis next weekend and let the hype begin.
Okay, so this is your head pick. Would your heart pick be any different?
I would sort of like to see the Bears because Lovie Smith has done a great job there. And God knows there are no more pleasant fans in the world than Bears fans when they're winning. So I'd sort of like to see that, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Hotel rates in the city that hosts the Super Bowl always skyrocket because this is, after all, America. But hotel owners in and around Detroit, where Super Bowl XL will occur, are complaining that they may not be able to realize the windfall to which supply and demand should entitle them. What's the problem?
Well, apparently there are still hurricane evacuees there, and they're supposed to be gone by now, and they're not. Thereby depriving the owners of the God-given right to gouge tourists. Considering the kind of beastly publicity this Super Bowl has already gotten from the nation's media, this doesn't help.
In New Orleans this week, Charlie, the city council passed a resolution urging the Saints to name Doug Williams as their head coach. Where do you suppose that item stood on the agenda of the New Orleans City Council?
It boggles the mind, although maybe it's in the staggering welter of unsolvable problems that city council has been handed. Maybe this is one they feel like it solves.
Elsewhere in pro football, oil magnate Boone Pickens has donated $165 million to Oklahoma State University and their football program. Most of the money will go to creating a bowl in the football stadium's west end zone, whatever that means. What do you suppose they do with the rest? Buy running backs?
Well, that's been the history, but it would be wrong of us to speculate. I don't know why Boone Pickens doesn't just build a pyramid and be done with it. I mean, he's fashioning his own monument, for God's sakes. He should just build a pyramid out in the desert and you know, carve his name in hieroglyphs along the side and be done with it.
Like Ozymandias, King of Kings. The U.S. Figure Skating Championships are ongoing in St. Louis, and I love the comments of Emily Hughes, currently in second place, when she was asked if any skaters left off the Olympic team would be likely to sue if Michelle Kwan made the team via a medical waiver. Ms. Hughes said, quote, "You never know what's going to happen. You know, the ice is very slippery."
Nice little career you've got there, Michelle. Be a shame if anything happened to it. Well, I mean, if you really have a problem with the so-called litigious society, it's nice to see Ms. Hughes taking matters into her own hands.
Skier Bodie Miller, who maintained in Sunday's 60 Minutes interview that it was hard to ski a slalom course while drunk, took it back this week. Does that mean that it isn't hard to ski a slalom course while drunk?
Well, I know people who find it hard to get down the hallway in that condition, so I imagine he was telling the truth the first time. This is another made-for-TV, what-shall-we-do-about-the-children apology that will keep the people in my business who are enamored of such things from clutching their pearls very tightly over the next 2 weeks. It's purely a PR stunt. He said something truthful and dumb, and that's the worst thing you can do these days.
Dave Andrechuk, who less than 2 years ago was the toast of the NHL after he captained the Tampa Bay Lightning to its first Stanley Cup victory, is now toast himself. He was released by the Lightning, who now claim that the 42-year-old's game is, quote, not suited to the new NHL. That's a little cold, isn't it?
Well, it is cold, but in a way it makes sense. I mean, the new NHL is a faster and quite honestly, more younger league. And, you know, as we know, the Tampa Bay Lightning are still the defending Stanley Cup champions until someone just dethrones them. It's too bad, though. I think it could have been handled in a more discreet way.
A 28-year-old man in Montreal jumped onto the ice during a Canadiens practice on Monday, and he was prepared. He was wearing skates. He had a stick. Did the story have a happy ending?
Well, he's sort of reprimanded by the assembled Canadiens, but I'm going to tell you, this is the best thing I've heard, the best news I've heard for the Canadiens in years. If people are still impressed enough by the Canadiens to crash their practices, maybe they can back to their former eminence.
Well, my favorite phony ending of this story said that before the authorities in Montreal could hustle this guy off the ice, he was signed by the Penguins.
He did get one shot off, though, which is interesting.
It was stopped, though. That was too bad. And finally, Charlie, I knew the Indy Racing League was in trouble. Its popularity has been declining. But until this week, I didn't realize how desperate the folks at IRL were. I am Indy. I am Indy. Hey. Yes, it's Gene Simmons. So, time to kiss Indy Racing goodbye?
Well, hopefully not with that giant tongue that was so famous from the Kiss concert. I don't know. Did they lose the phone number for Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose? I have no idea.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and in case you missed the product placement last week, he's also writing a book about Tom Brady. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. I am Mindy. Hey. I am Mindy. Hey. I am Mindy. Hey. I am Mindy. Hey. For some reason, there are those who seek to turn any harmless and enjoyable activity into a competitive one. Hence, frisbee competitions, dog shows, skillet tossing, wife carrying, and the like. And now there's competitive eating. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor attended the 2005 Verizon Voice Wing Battle, and he has this report.
Eric Badlands Booker is not the first athlete to put out a rap album, but he's probably the only MC that can eat 4 pounds of corned beef hash in less than 2 minutes. The 420-pound Booker has two albums, Hungry and Focused and Hungry and Focused 2, The Ingestion Engine. Both albums are mostly about his sport, competitive eating, which makes sense. After all, this isn't a concert, it's merely a warm-up to the 2005 Verizon Voice Wing Battle. Today's event is further proof that competitive eating has moved beyond the realm of the county fair apple pie chowdown. Competitions are run by the International Federation of Competitive Eating. The crown jewel of the IFOCE circuit is the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Championship on Coney Island. That's been an annual 4th of July event on ESPN for years. Corporate sponsors are now bankrolling contests that can earn winners thousands of dollars. It's not enough for most to live on, but it's certainly enough to keep competitors like Booker on the circuit.
I mean, when I first started, I just did Nathan's. It got my, you know, got my year supply of hot dogs and my trophy. Look forward to the next year's contest. Now I'm doing a contest, at least two contests a month. All right, various foods.
There's a new generation of gurgitators stepping up the level of competition. Joey Chestnut is a 21-year-old from San Jose, California, and a rookie on the IFOCE circuit. Chestnut looks like the kid next door with a buzz cut and a low-key attitude. When you meet him, you'd have no clue he's the number 3 ranked eater in the world. Chestnut recently won the World Grilled Cheese title by consuming 32.5 sandwiches in 10 minutes. Chestnut says he prepares to engorge mass quantities of food by drinking gallons of water at a time.
If I'm going to get on stage, I might as well try to win. And what it takes to win is a little bit of training, and that's what I got to do.
Edward Cookie Jarvis, a veteran on the circuit, claims he was one of the inventors of water training.
That was my first training regimen. Yeah. I used to do, the first time I drank a gallon of water, it took me like 3 minutes. I have it down to a minute flat. 59 seconds is the best time I've ever done for a gallon. I've drinking 2 gallons in 2 minutes or 25 seconds. That's 17 pounds of water. It's gaining birth.
Jarvis, a married father of 2, is a Long Island realtor. On game day, the 400-pound cookie arrives with an American flag do-rag and a jacket covered with patches commemorating his more than 30 titles. On the back is an airbrushed picture of himself called Mini Cookie. Jarvis says family demands will soon force him to retire from eating, at least competitively, but there are plenty of characters here today that hope to take his place. There's Jason Erb, the herbivore. Humble Bob Shout, the vegetarian who only eats meat during competitions. The contestant in wrestling-style face paint who goes by the name of Eater X. And the man who perhaps is the biggest name in competitive eating.
A guy can bring worlds together, and when you bring worlds together, planets collide, and I want a big, rousing hometown welcome for this man, Crazy Legs Compton!
Crazy Legs Conti may be number 18 in the IFOC rankings, but he's the sport's number 1 ambassador. At the opening of a documentary based on his eating exploits, Conti ate his way out of a popcorn sarcophagus, which earned him the nickname the Houdini of Cuisine. For those who claim competitive eating has turned into something like professional wrestling, with a lot more food, Conti has an answer.
Competitive eating, these are just guys and women who have loved food, who want to become gustatory gladiators. They just happen to be eccentric. Everything you see here is legitimate. There's no faking eating 5 pounds of chicken wing meat in 10 minutes.
That's an exploit to which there is a method. Conti says he's perfected a technique he calls the meat umbrella.
The drumsticks, you spin it, basically, in your mouth. The paddles pose difficulty for a lot of eaters. I take the hinge with my forefingers and I push the meat down as I'm chewing a drumstick so that the meat basically pops at the bottom of the wing as sort of an umbrella, and I can just flip that up into my mouth and the bone never comes into play.
She ate 46 dozen Louisiana oysters in 10 minutes. She is the top-ranked eater in the United States of America. She is here for the Rise and Voice Wing Battle at King. Ladies and gentlemen, bring around Sonia Thomas!
Whatever method Sonia Thomas employs, it usually works. She's the number 2 eater in the world, although at 100 pounds, no one's figured out where she puts it all. Her nickname, the Black Widow, says being the smallest competitor and one of the few women on the circuit isn't a problem.
Look at that. All the eating contestants were all male, right? So I'm the female. The Black Widow is a female spider, right? Spider kill the male spider and eat them, right? So when I come against the men, and I beat them and I kill them and win.
And most expect Thomas to do just that today. The only eater ranked higher than the Black Widow is 5-time Nathan's champion, Takeru Kobayashi. But he's in Japan, so the Black Widow has a clear opportunity as the contest begins.
From 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
For 12 minutes, the dozen or so contestants line a long table and gorge while onlookers cheer. Thomas and Chestnut are plowing through 3-pound trays of wing meat at an alarming rate. By the 6-minute mark, Badland Booker's shirt is covered in wing sauce. Crazy Legs Conti has abandoned the meat umbrella method in favor of the shove as much chicken in your mouth as you can technique. By the 9-minute mark, the pace has definitely slowed. Conti has so much food in his mouth, it's not clear what he'll stop doing first, chew or breathe. Meanwhile, the Black Widow and Chestnut seem to be running neck and neck, right until the end.
4, 3, 2, stop eating, ladies and gentlemen!
Now, with the wing battle over, the contestants line up with their trays of wing carcasses and head to the scales for the weigh-in. Some are still chewing or forcing down what's left in their mouths with whatever fluid they can find.
3.2.
Finally, the judges determine the winner, and it's an upset.
And in first place, with 4.2 pounds of wing meat off the bone, ladies and gentlemen, Joey Chestnut from Soho!
Shockingly, the Black Widow has finished fourth. A visibly upset Thomas quietly leaves the club as Joey Chestnut collects his oversized check for $3,500. After his victory, a confident Chestnut says his next goal is to defeat Kobayashi. Crazy Legs Conti has an even loftier goal for his sport.
Certainly, people no longer need to ask, is this a sport? That's been answered. The question is, where is the sport going? And I think you're going to see TV shows, movies, oversized trading cards. And finally, I think it'll be in the Olympics. Every athlete who wins a gold medal is using food for fuel. Why not make the food the event?
On November 19th at the Crystal Hamburger Championship in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Joey Chestnut almost pulled off the unthinkable. Kobayashi, whose only loss on American soil was to a Kodiak bear, mounted a furious comeback to edge Chestnut in the final minute. Maybe Kobayashi can be beaten after all. For only a game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston. You eat like a sumo, can't feed your man. Around the fifth plate, he realized who I am. They call me Badlands Booker. Super fly like Ron O'Neill and Snooker. Putting the pressure on eaters like cookers. Put on the show for pressing on lookers. Bobbing, weep, shaking, baking, shook. Good like coffee with the cream and sugar. You know my name, I got that fame. For cramming food down my esophageal drain. Never near, extraordinaire, or competing, eating. Bobbing, weaving, shaking, baked passion, creams. Never heaving, green soul, losing, achieving. Straight top seeing, greatness to see. Out my pores, do this for you and yours. Blow your doors, eating rebel with no pores. Want to post in buffets and grocery stores. Wash your lemons when I eat. I'm just like
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Matt Trevethan at WDET in Detroit. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to check out Gabe O'Connor's Competitive Eating Photo Gallery, view a slideshow featuring, what else, sliders. Listen to stories past and present or sign up for our newsletter. Please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from former Texas Western coach Don Haskins, who praises author Dan Wetzel for the job he did on Glory Road.
Dan's one of the best writers in the world, and I even liked his book.
Coach, it's really supposed to be your book, and what you're really saying is... never mind. You're the coach. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Put the pressure on eaters like cookers. Put on the show for pressing on lookers. Bobbing, weave, shaking, baking, shook. Good like coffee with the cream and sugar. You know my name, I got that thing for cramming food down my esophageal drain. They call me Badlands Booker. Putting pressure on eaters like cookers. Bobbing, weave, shaking, baking, shook, yeah. You know my name, I got that thing for cramming food down my esophageal drain.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public.